as in the previous episode, this episode is a follow-up to episode 28 on Augustine of Hippo. In this episode, we're going to go into a little more depth on what was mentioned in that episode, Augustine's debate with, first of all, the Donatists of North Africa, and then a British monk by the name of Pelagius. And we begin with his debate with the Donatists and the controversy that's named after them. The Donatist controversy came about as a result of the persecutions of the church that had taken place at the close of the 3rd century. And we covered all of that in episode 14, titled, What Do We Do With Them? Official persecution of Christians under the Roman Empire, it tended to be sporadic and regional. Emperors might call for a general clampdown on the followers of Jesus, but it was left to regional governors to decide how strictly they would enforce it. Some of those governors ignored the policy because they knew that Christians were good citizens, an asset to the realm. Others, for whatever reason, used the emperor's command as an excuse to brutalize the church. That changed with Diocletian at the end of the 3rd century. At the urging of his co-emperor, Galerius, Diocletian pressed for a harsh empire-wide crackdown on Christians. Their leaders and scriptures were special targets. Now, during this time, not a few bishops and elders of the church caved to the pressure and recanted their faith. Others offered up precious manuscripts of scripture to be burnt. When Constantine came to the throne a short time later and issued an official revocation of persecution, the church was faced with the challenge of what to do with these bishops who'd shamefully recanted their faith, their cowardice all the worse, as it was set over against the backdrop of a large number of just everyday believers, including some teenage girls and young mothers like Felicitas and Perpetua, who'd bravely faced the wild beasts in the arena, or were burned at the stake, or had heavy stones tied around their feet and then dropped in rivers. The haters came up with ingenious means to dispose of Jesus' people. Some of those bishops who recanted repented their recanting and then politely asked if maybe, perchance, they could get their job back. In Europe, the general policy was to treat each bishop case by case. Every situation was unique and so was handled that way. One bishop might be restored while another was not, depending on the judge's grievousness of his temporary apostasy. A bishop who recanted publicly and profusely while merely being threatened with torment was deemed more culpable than the bishop who had recanted while delirious from long torture and intense pain. Some church leaders bore the marks of their torture for years after they ministered under the new regime. I mean, imagine going to church next Sunday to see your pastor missing an eye or with deep scars on his arms from the torture that he had endured years ago for being a Christian. It would tend to make your confidence in his sincerity of faith more sure. It might add a little more gravitas to his words. While it was the policy in Europe to try lapsed bishops on a case-by-case basis, it was different in North Africa, where we'll just say the standards of morality were a bit higher. It was in Egypt, you'll remember, that the Desert Fathers, the hermits, had begun. The life of the ascetic hermit was still valued. The church there was not inclined to restore lapsed, repentant bishops. This view was led by a bishop named Donatus. Their policy came into conflict with Rome, which had the lead in the Western church. A long, brewing tension between the churches of Europe led by Rome and the churches of North Africa led by Carthage got even tenser when Rome declared North Africa to be an official error. But the real heart of the Donatist controversy wasn't really over whether or not lapsed bishops, traditores as they were called, could be restored to their office. No, the real point of deepest contention was over whether or not the baptisms and communion performed by lapsed bishops counted. Donatus said that if Jimmy was baptized by a lapsed bishop, it was as if Jimmy had never been baptized because that bishop had no authority to baptize. Same with communion. The best a lapsed bishop could do was, I guess, give somebody a snack or get them wet. Now we get to Augustine's part in all of this. When he became bishop at Hippo in North Africa, that's where the Donatists were thriving. In some places, they formed a majority. Augustine supported the Roman position against them. He argued against the Donatists, saying that Well, according to Jesus' parable of the wheat and the tares, the church was a mixed multitude, holding both the lost and the saved. Now, I'm at a loss to see how that justified allowing part-time apostates to regain leadership positions in the church. Let's consider that in light of some of the scandals that we've seen in recent times. Should a pastor caught in adultery be allowed to continue as a pastor just because he breaks up with his mistress? An elder whose anger regularly gets the better of him so that he gets into fights, isn't he disqualified to continue as an elder? We might better ask, how did he ever become one in the first place? Don't forget that the term bishop that we see so often in the writing of the early church fathers is really synonymous with today's lead or senior pastor. In the New Testament, the words elder, pastor, and bishop all refer to the same office. Elder refers to their mature character. Bishops refer to the authority that's given them by God to lead. And while pastor is the same word as shepherd, and it describes what he's to do, lead, feed, and protect God's flock. The criteria for elders is given by the Apostle Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1. Now, here's the list from the Timothy passage. We read, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous, one who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. Moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Now, it seems to me that the policy adopted by the churches of Europe was a more biblically sound approach than the Donatists' blanket rejection. But at the same time, one wonders how many lapsed bishops were reinstalled in their churches just because they were likable or gifted speakers. Well, we don't know because no account was made. But knowing human nature, sure, some of those traditores climb back into their role as pastor who were no longer, as the Apostle Paul says, an elder ought to be, blameless. How many had utterly lost their testimony among outsiders? But for Augustine, the issue wasn't so much that these lapsed priests and bishops were allowed back into their roles. It was more the question of whether or not their religious service held any efficacy for those they served. The baptisms they performed were still legitimate, as was the communion they served, because it wasn't the faith of the officiant that mattered. It was the faith of those being baptized and receiving communion. Augustine differed from the Donatists on the validity of baptism communion served by lapsed but restored priests. Donatists claimed that an apostate had lost authority to administer the rites. But Augustine said the moral and spiritual standing of a pastor wasn't important, only that he, and pay close attention to this because it's important, only that the officiating minister be aware that he bestowed God's grace on others by baptizing and serving communion. Now, while we might agree that the moral excellence of an officiating minister doesn't determine the value of communion and baptism, some will find it difficult to accept the idea that a special grace is communicated by a priest or a pastor through these rituals. And this brings up a much later controversy that will surface during the Reformation. Do the sacraments convey grace, or are they meant as memorials pointing to a historical event that we renew faith by? Note that I did not say that they're merely memorials, for I think that goes too far and misrepresents the position of the Reformers. That's a subject for a much later episode. Augustine's argument at this point laid the foundation for the Roman Catholic Church's doctrine that an ordained priest becomes the channel of grace to church members. And next stop on that train is sacramentalism, sacerdotalism, subjects that we'll explore in future episodes. Just make a mental note, they're rooted in Augustine's debate with the Donatists. Those Donatists thought they'd gained an advantage in the debate in 387 when a local leader rebelled against Rome and managed to form a quasi-independent regime in North Africa. The Donatists assumed they no longer had to worry about imperial forces meddling in church affairs since the new ruler supported them. When Augustine settled into Hippo as bishop there, he immediately went to work refuting the theology of the Donatists, seeing it as a major threat and challenge to Catholic doctrine. The Donatists' luck ran out in 398 when Rome reasserted control over their region. Now it was the Catholics who would be calling the shots, backed by imperial power. Now Augustine had been preparing for this. He joined with the statesman Bishop Aurelius of Carthage to attempt negotiations with the Donatists. But the divide between the two camps was too wide, it was too deep. When the Donatists remained determined to stick by their now century-long beliefs, the contest degenerated into violence. A frustrated Augustine supported harsh measures against the Donatists by misapplying Luke chapter 14, verse 23. In the parable of the banquet, the host said, "Compel them to come in." Augustine used this to justify forcing opponents to comply. That seems an odd application of a passage that's self-explanatory. The servants of the host in that parable, didn't they go out and beat people, driving them with whips into the banquet? Yet that is what Augustine now advocated in compelling the Donatists to forsake their obstinacy and just agree to sit at Rome's table. The lingering tragedy of this episode in Augustine's life is that the course he took with the Donatists became the template for later church leaders during the Middle Ages and the Reformation to force compliance with church dictates. Augustine was held in such high regard, the attitude of many churchmen was that if Augustine said or did something, it was the pattern and path that God wanted for all of his servants to walk. Yet if this was how the work of God is done, then why does Jesus mark out his own meekness as the example that his people are to follow? In Matthew 11, Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Jesus invites us to follow. He doesn't force or make us follow. He offers a yoke, but we must step into it. He doesn't slam it on our necks. He never compels the yoke of following him. Augustine, as brilliant as he was simply wrong in sanctioning the use of state power to force compliance to church dictates. And now we turn to the debate Augustine had with a British monk named Pelagius. Now, we could have dealt with this in a paragraph or two in the episode on Augustine, but I thought it wise to spend a bit more time on it for this reason. One of the more contentious debates among Protestants is between Calvinists and Arminianists. And right off the bat, I have to qualify that by saying those two terms, we're covering a lot of theological territory. They become simplistic as categories for the debate. Nevertheless, they're terms that most people are at least vaguely aware of. Now, in that debate, one side regularly labels the other as Pelagian or semi-Pelagian. Since Pelagianism has been labeled as heretical, the charge of being Pelagian is a way to shut down discussion and to end the debate. It's not my intent here to argue the merits of either side in that discussion, though I do, of course, have my view. I simply want to provide a little, well, historical context to what those terms mean. Oh, here we go. Following his refutation of Donatism, Augustine turned his impressive intellectual attention to the teaching of a British monk named Pelagius. Pelagius's beginnings in Britain are obscure. Nothing is known of his origins. While the evidence says that he began in Britain, the typically sneering church father Jerome mocks him as Irish. I guess for some reason that means we could just disregard him. Well, for whatever reason, he arrived in Rome in 380, where he was disturbed by the moral laxity that he observed in the churches there, especially among the upper classes. People seemed to want instruction, but treated what they learned as a mere academic exercise rather than instructions meant to alter behavior. These elites gathered around them what they deemed suitably capable teachers. Now, there was no dearth of candidates vying to make it onto their demanding roster. Few did, and with a haughty but certified scholar, Jerome, left Rome in 384, Pelagius stepped into his vacancy. His fluency in both Greek and Latin, combined with his lucidity in theology, propelled him into the spotlight. But his was an unlikely choice, since Pelagius made no secret of his campaign to reform the morals of the Roman Church. He concluded that what had led to the abysmal state of morality in Rome was a faulty view of grace and human ability. This led him straight into conflict with Augustine, because it was his work that had best articulated the theology of many, though by no means all, on these fronts. It seemed to Pelagius that Augustine had reduced human beings to mere tools of divine pleasure, that they had little agency, that all was determined by God. Augustine represented a group of church leaders who fell in line with the thinking of another North African theologian of two centuries before, Tertullian. Elaborating on the seed thoughts that he had proposed, they said that humanity was irrevocably broken by sin. Because all humanity was in Adam when he fell, they fell with him, and proved the truth of that when they finally arrive in the world, without exception, they sin themselves. It's called the doctrine of original sin. I'm sure you've heard of it. Pelagius thought that this was a dangerous excuse for sin, and that it robbed people of any reason to attempt trying to be good and making, you know, any effort at being moral. He assumed that people would think, hey, if I'm already guilty but haven't really done what I'm declared guilty of, I might as well go ahead and do what I'm already guilty for. That wasn't really what original sin said, but it fit the narrative that Pelagius had already settled on. He was set on improving the morality of the people of Rome through a rigorous campaign of asceticism. And he said that our God-given nature has been damaged but isn't completely corrupted. We can, he claimed, make right and good choices on our own. But Pelagius acknowledged the very ability to make choice comes from God. He said, quote, that we are able to see with our eyes is no power of ours, but it is in our power that we make a good or bad use of our eyes. The fact that we have the power of accomplishing every good thing by action, speech, and thought comes from him who has endowed us with this possibility and also assists it, unquote. As often happens, it was Pelagius's followers who pressed his views further. They cried foul on the idea of original sin. The guilt of Adam's sin was not, they said, passed on to the rest of humanity. Rather, Adam was just a bad example that we ought to ignore. We're free to choose God apart from divine assistance or enabling. In this, Pelagius's followers went further than their leader. Now, Augustine went to work refuting Pelagius when refugees from Italy began arriving in North Africa after the sack of Rome in 410. Some of these refugees spread Pelagius's ideas in their new home. Augustine was concerned that their ideas would start up yet another controversy on top of the Donatists. While his relationship with Pelagius himself remained polite, the same cannot be said for the way that it worked out with his followers. Moves and countermoves saw a complex mix of schemes as the two camps tried to outmaneuver each other for control of the doctrinal narrative. Augustine prevailed, and the Council of Carthage in 418 declared Pelagianism a heresy. Not long after, the term Pelagian came to be a kind of umbrella term for all heresy, and that's the way things sat until more recent times. Modern scholars have revisited Pelagius's teachings. The modern take on Pelagius is that he regarded the human race as less vile, less broken than Augustine, and so had a more positive view of human nature. Now, maybe he did, but we ought not miss the fact that Pelagius was a staunch, strict moralist. He envisioned the church as something very different from Augustine, who in the City of God sets it not as a collection of living, holy, morally pure saints, but as a community of people who by God's grace have been changed and who want to be holy, but who, this side of heaven, will ever strive and never arrive. Contrasting the two, for Augustine, sanctification was a process carried on by the sovereign activity of the Holy Spirit. For Pelagius, the emphasis and energy for being holy lay within the grasp of men and women, but it was accompanied by God's grace. It was his immediate and later followers who pressed the responsibility of Christians to work their side of the holiness equation that led eventually to placing the entire burden of sanctification on human endeavor alone. Then they worked that process backward and said that salvation itself was a product of the human will. Now, we saw this process of followers hijacking a founder's ideas with Nestorius. While Nestorius was ornery and politically inept, and while he struggled with framing his thoughts on the nature of Christ in accurate terms, he was orthodox in his beliefs. It was Nestorius's followers who reframed his ideas along aberrant lines. What we may discern in the difference between these two is their own unique experiences with temptation and sin. Remember that before his conversion, Augustine had struggled with a besetting sin of sexual avarice. His many-year quest to gain mastery over this area proved fruitless until he surrendered to Christ. And we might assume from the long record of human experience that sexual temptation didn't end overnight for Augustine. He knew the presence of that brokenness in himself even after being born again. But he also discovered a new center that saw him able to resist its pull that he'd not had before. This he attributed to the sovereign agency of God's enabling grace, not to anything within himself. Though we know nothing of Pelagius' background in Britain, that he was shocked at the immorality of Roman Christians when he first arrived in Rome, we may infer that he already had a fine-tuned sense of right and wrong with a moral discipline in sync with that. Maybe the biggest impact of Pelagius was in how the contest with him influenced Augustine's theology. It appears to some biographers that Augustine's defense of original sin and his emerging views on the necessity of God's grace, well, they may have moved him to dig out some of the ideas that he had picked up years before from the Manichaeans and the Stoics. Combining all of that led him to conclude that salvation is so completely a work of God that it lies in the time before time. It rests in the inscrutable will of God. Some would say that because Augustine maintained that salvation was so utterly independent of anything in man, that God's choice was arbitrary, lying in some divine reason beyond human ability to ever know. It ought to be noted that Augustine's ideas did not meet with automatic, unanimous approval in his day. It's not like he published these things and church leaders said, "Well, of course, this is what we've always believed." No, criticism of his theology of grace was widespread. But it was wrapped in a pill that was easy at that time to swallow. His The City of God that we looked at in our last episode. The Western Christian world was so eager to make sense of the fall of Rome that they ate up Augustine's analysis and vision. It offered hope at a time when it was desperately needed, and it provided a blueprint for how to move forward. So along came his ideas on the nature of grace and salvation. But they remained mostly quiet in the background until the Reformation, when theologians returned to the writings of the Church Fathers. Then, Augustine's views on predestination and election were resurrected by one branch of the emerging Protestant movement. But not by all. Other Protestants replied with the same objections that had been used when Augustine first proposed his ideas. That debate goes on today, with modern adherents of Augustine calling those who disagree with him Pelagian, which has come to mean not what Pelagius himself actually taught, but what some of his followers eventually said, that people can be saved by living a holy life apart from the atoning work of Christ. But non-Augustinian Christians would say that they don't believe that. They contend that there is no salvation apart from Christ, but that people come to faith in him by responding to the conviction of the Holy Spirit who woos and wins them. The label semi-Pelagian has been assigned to this position by Augustinians and is deemed as heretical as full Pelagianism. It's interesting that this view is called semi-Pelagian when in truth it's more aligned with what Pelagius himself taught. Confused? Welcome to the club.